Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for In the News and American Stories, coming up after As It Is.
Hello again, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. Today on the program, we have two stories about the Korean Peninsula. A top United States intelligence official says that North Korea has made progress in developing long-range missiles. This comes as the possibility of deploying a U.S. missile defense system in South Korea has gained attention. James Clapper is the National Intelligence Director for the United States. He recently wrote to the U.S. Congress saying that North Korea has made progress in developing a missile that could reach the U.S. He said that North Korea has taken steps to test a long-range intercontinental ballistic missile, or ICBM. David Stilwell is an official with the U.S. Department of Defense. He recently said that the North Korean missile threat has created what he calls a demand for the THAAD missile defense system in South Korea. THAAD is an acronym for Terminal High Altitude Area Defense. Shin In-kyun is a security expert with the Korea Defense Network. He said South Korea is more concerned with short-range missile threats, not ICBMs. The THAAD missile defense system is able to track objects up to 1,000 kilometers away. It is designed to stop ballistic missiles at high altitudes. He said ICBMs cannot attack South Korea due to the limits of the missile's firing range. He believes that Mr. Clapper's comments on ICBMs actually expressed concern about a possible cut in the U.S. defense budget. China and Russia opposed the use of a THAAD system in South Korea. They say the system could possibly be used to intercept their missiles. They say this would increase U.S. military capabilities in the area. Officials in South Korea have avoided any formal declaration on THAAD. They say no official request has come from the U.S. and that no official consultations have been made. They also say South Korea has not decided whether to place a THAAD system on the Korean Peninsula. North Korea has not started testing any ICBMs. But experts with the U.S.-Korea Institute say there is photographic evidence that shows rocket engine testing and construction in North Korea. They say that North Korea may have a functioning ICBM within the next 3 to 5 years. But ongoing sanctions and technical problems could delay development by years or even decades. North Korea also must complete a number of tests before the ICBM is ready for use. Shin In-kyun said a missile must go through at least 10 firing tests and must pass at least 7. He estimates it will take several more years for North Korea to build a working ICBM. It is not known how close North Korea is to developing a small nuclear device that could be used on a ballistic missile. General Curtis Scaparotti is the commander of U.S. Forces Korea. Last year, he said he believed North Korea has the expertise and ability to build a small nuclear device. South Korean Minister of Defense Han Min-koo also said North Korea has made progress in its nuclear device technology. You are listening to As It Is from VOA. Learning English. The United States ambassador to South Korea continues to recover from a knife attack. Mark Lippert was released from a hospital in Seoul on March 10th, 5 days after he was repeatedly stabbed in the capital. Jim Tedder has more.
A South Korean supporter of North Korea cut Ambassador Lippert on the face and hand. Police arrested 55-year-old Kim Ki-jong immediately following the attack. He faces charges including attempted murder. But officials say the attacker might have also violated a law designed to stop the spread of communism. Some rights groups oppose the law. They say it mostly limits freedom of speech without increasing public safety. Police searched Mr. Kim's home and office. They say they found documents supporting North Korea. South Korea's national security law bans such documents. Park Kun-young is a member of the group People's Solidarity for Participatory Democracy. He opposes the law and is worried about how the government might use it. He says it is bad that the attack carried out by one violent man is bringing attention to other activists who do not share the South Korean government's thoughts on North Korea. He says the South Korean government might now use the national security law to try to punish its political opponents. Lawmakers approved the measure in the late 1940s to try to stop the spread of communist North Korea's influence. But rights activists say it restricts freedom of speech and gives the government power to send innocent people to jail. In 2012, 26-year-old photographer Park Jung-gun was found guilty of violating the law. Last year, a higher court canceled the ruling and said the man was innocent. Mr. Park says he was charged because of a humorous comment he made about North Korea on the social networking website Twitter. Mr. Park says he is now more careful about what he communicates on social media. Many South Koreans support the national security law. They say the fight against North Korea is continuing. Sa Jung-kup is a member of the organization National Action Campaign in South Korea. He says the attack on the American ambassador proves that the government needs to take stronger action against South Koreans who support North Korea. He says North Korea is the world's worst dictatorship. He says it launched attacks in 2010 and killed 46 South Korean soldiers. He says he does not think issues like the economy and human rights are as important as that of uniting the nation. Critics of the law say they agree that North Korea is still a threat to South Korea. But they say the attack on the ambassador shows that the law does not keep people safe from attack. That is one reason why activist Park Kun-young says the law should be canceled. He says security is important and the country needs laws to stop spies. But he says the national security law does not do that. He says it only stops people from expressing their opinions. I'm Jim Tedder.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow for another As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans. Thanks for listening.
In the News is next, followed by American Stories. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is In the News. The deal between Iran and six world powers to place limits on Iran's nuclear program has brought reactions from cheers to alarm around the world. Negotiators reached a framework of an agreement after 8 days of intensive negotiation in Lausanne, Switzerland. President Barack Obama praised the agreement as historic and a good deal that meets our core objectives. He said the agreement would make the world safer and keep Iran from building a nuclear weapon if fully carried out. The president said the limits placed on Iran would be the strongest in history.
This framework would cut off every pathway that Iran could take to develop a nuclear weapon. Iran will face strict limitations on its program, and Iran has also agreed to the most robust and intrusive inspections and transparency regime ever negotiated for any nuclear program in history.
Many Iranians welcomed news of the agreement, which would ease existing sanctions in exchange for a list of requirements meant to keep Iran from building a nuclear bomb. Supporters welcomed Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif on his return to Tehran. Hundreds of Iranians celebrated in the streets in hopes that their country's economic isolation would come to an end. And Iranian President Hassan Rouhani called it a day that will remain in the historical memory of the Iranian nation. Iranian hardliners, on the other hand, denounced the agreement as a bad deal. In Israel, the reaction was of alarm. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called an emergency meeting of his security cabinet Friday. He expressed strong opposition to the agreement. He said it would pose a grave danger to the region and to the world, and would threaten the very survival of the State of Israel. He also said it helps Iran's economy while raising the risk of a nuclear arms race in the area. The reaction was more restrained in the Gulf region. Saudi official media reported that King Salman voiced hope that a final settlement on the nuclear dispute would strengthen the stability and security of the region and the world, in a phone call with President Obama. Besides the U.S., Britain, China, France, Russia, and Germany negotiated the deal. Under the agreement, Iran is required to pull back its abilities to create a nuclear weapon. United Nations inspections of all of Iran's nuclear facilities would be increased in order to verify that the agreement was being followed. In exchange, Iran will receive relief from international sanctions. President Obama indicated that many details of the agreement have yet to be reached. He said on Thursday that the deal would be finalized over the next 3 months. In his words, nothing is agreed to until everything is agreed. He also warned that if Iran violates the deal, sanctions can be snapped back into place, although critics question how that could be done quickly or easily. In Congress, Republican lawmakers have threatened to pass new sanctions on Iran. President Obama said critics of his effort to make a nuclear deal with Iran were wrong. He said failure to reach a deal would be called a failure of U.S. diplomacy. If fully carried out, the deal could be considered the most important international agreement of Mr. Obama's presidency. And that's In the News from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
Now, the VOA Special English Program, American Stories. Today, we complete the story, Paul's Case. It was written by Willa Cather. Here is Kay Gallant with the story.
Paul was a student with a lot of problems. He hated school. He didn't like living with his family on Cordelia Street in the industrial city of Pittsburgh. Paul wanted to be surrounded by beautiful things. He loved his part-time job as an usher at the concert hall. He helped people find their seats before the concert. Then he could listen to the music and dream of exciting places. Paul also spent a lot of time at the local theater. He knew many of the actors who worked there. He used to do little jobs for them, and they would let him see plays for free. Paul had little time left for his studies, so he was always in trouble with his teachers. Finally, Paul's teachers complained again to his father. His father took him out of school and made him take a job in a large company. He would not let Paul go near the concert hall or the theater. Paul did not like his job as a messenger boy. He began to plan his escape. A few weeks later, Paul's boss, Mr. Denny, gave Paul a large amount of money to take to the bank. He told Paul to hurry because it was Friday afternoon. He said the bank would close soon and would not open again until Monday. At the bank, Paul took the money out of his pocket. It was $5,000. Paul put the money back in his coat pocket, and he walked out of the bank. He went to the train station and bought a one-way ticket for New York City. That afternoon, Paul left Pittsburgh forever. The train traveled slowly through a January snowstorm. The slow movement made Paul fall asleep. The train whistle blew just as the sun was coming up. Paul awoke, feeling dirty and uncomfortable. He quickly touched his coat pocket. The money was still there. It was not a dream. He really was on his way to New York City with $5,000 in his pocket. Finally, the train pulled into Central Station. Paul walked quickly out of the station and went immediately to an expensive clothing store for men. The salesman was very polite when he saw Paul's money. Paul bought two suits, several white silk shirts, some silk ties of different colors. Then he bought a black tuxedo suit for the theater, a warm winter coat, a red bathrobe, and the finest silk underclothes. He told the salesman he wanted to wear one of the new suits and the coat immediately. The salesman bowed and smiled. Paul then took a taxi to another shop, where he bought several pairs of leather shoes and boots. Next, he went to the famous jewelry store, Tiffany's, and bought a tie pin and some brushes with silver handles. His last stop was a luggage store, where he had all his new clothes put into several expensive suitcases. It was a little before 1 o'clock in the afternoon when Paul arrived at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. The doorman opened the hotel's glass doors for Paul, and the boy entered. The thick carpet under his feet had the colors of 1,000 jewels, The lights sparkled from crystal chandeliers. Paul told the hotel clerk he was from Washington, D.C. He said his mother and father were arriving in a few days from Europe. He explained he was going to wait for them at the hotel. In his dreams, Paul had planned this trip to New York 100 times. He knew all about the Waldorf Astoria, one of New York's most expensive hotels. As soon as he entered his rooms, he saw that everything was perfect, except for one thing. He rang the bell and asked for fresh flowers to be sent quickly to his rooms. When the flowers came, Paul put them in water, and then he took a long, hot bath. He came out of the bathroom wearing the red silk bathrobe. Outside his windows, the snow was falling so fast that he could not see across the street. But inside, the air was warm and sweet. He lay down on the sofa in his sitting room. It had all been so very simple, he thought. When they had shut him out of the theater and the concert hall, Paul knew he had to leave. But he was surprised that he had not been afraid to go. He could not remember a time when he had not been afraid of something, even when he was a little boy. But now he felt free. He wasn't afraid anymore. He watched the snow until he fell asleep. It was 4 o'clock in the afternoon when Paul woke up. He spent nearly an hour getting dressed. He looked at himself often in the mirror. His dark blue suit fit him so well that he did not seem too thin. The white silk shirt and the blue and lilac tie felt cool and smooth under his fingers. He was exactly the kind of boy he had always wanted to be. Paul put on his new winter coat and went downstairs. He got into a taxi and told the driver to take him for a ride along Fifth Avenue. Paul stared at the expensive stores. As the taxi stopped for a red light, Paul noticed a flower shop. Through the window, he could see all kinds of flowers. Paul thought the violets, roses, and lilies of the valley looked even more lovely because they were blooming in the middle of winter. Paul began to feel hungry, so he asked the taxi driver to take him back to the hotel. As he entered the dining room, the music of the hotel orchestra floated up to greet him. He sat at a table near a window. The fresh flowers, the white tablecloth, and the colored wine glasses pleased Paul's eyes. The soft music, the low voices of the people around him, and the soft popping of champagne corks whispered into Paul's ears. "This is what everyone wants," he thought. He could not believe he had ever lived in Pittsburgh on Cordelia Street. That belonged to another time and place. Paul lifted the crystal glass of champagne and drank the cold, precious, bubbling wine. He belonged here. Later that evening, Paul put on his black tuxedo and went to the opera. He felt perfectly at ease. He had only to look at his tuxedo to know he belonged with all the other beautiful people in the opera house. He didn't talk to anyone, but his eyes recorded everything. Paul's golden days went by without a shadow. He made each one as perfect as he could. On the eighth day after his arrival in New York, he found a report in the newspaper about his crime. It said that his father had paid the company the $5,000 that Paul had stolen. It said Paul had been seen in a New York hotel. And it said Paul's father was in New York. He was looking for Paul to bring him back to Pittsburgh. Paul's knees became weak. He sat down in a chair and put his head in his hands. The dream was ended. He had to go back to Cordelia Street, back to the yellow-papered bedroom, the smell of cooked cabbage, the daily ride to work on the crowded streetcars. Paul poured himself a glass of champagne and drank it quickly. He poured another glass and drank that one too. Paul had a taxi take him out of the city and into the country. The taxi left him near some railroad tracks. Paul suddenly remembered all the flowers he had seen in a shop window his first night in New York. He realized that by now, every one of those flowers was dead. They had had only one splendid moment to challenge winter. A train whistle broke into Paul's thoughts. He watched as the train grew bigger and bigger. As it came closer, Paul's body shook. His lips wore a frightened smile. Paul looked nervously around as if someone might be watching him. When the right moment came, Paul jumped. And as he jumped, he realized his great mistake. The blue of the ocean and the yellow of the desert flashed through his brain. He had not seen them yet. There was so much he had not seen. Paul felt something hit his chest. He felt his body fly through the air far and fast. Then everything turned black, and Paul dropped back into the great design of things.
You have just heard the American story, Paul's Case. It was written by Willa Cather. Your storyteller was Kay Gallant. Listen again next week at this time for another American story told in special English on The Voice of America. I'm Steve Ember.